content of this program is intended for people who are sight or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first story today is actually written in July 14th of 2017, but it is applicable today and apparently has been brought back out by the magazine for publishing again, if you will. And it's entitled, What's Actually Wrong with the U.S. Health System? And it's written by Olga Kazan. On the heels of the Senate's latest attempt at replacing the Affordable Care Act, the Commonwealth Fund has released its latest evaluation of what exactly ails the U.S. healthcare system. Once again, the think tank found the U.S. medical system performed the worst among 11 similar countries, all while spending more. The United States fared especially badly on measures of affordability, access, health outcomes, and equality between the rich and the poor. The United Kingdom ranked first, and other countries in the comparison were Australia, Switzerland, Sweden, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Norway, Germany, Canada, and France. America does perform well comparatively when it comes to doctor-patient relationships, end-of-life care, and survival rates after major issues like breast cancer or strokes. However, the United States does less well on measures of population health. It had high rates of infant mortality and a low life expectancy at 60 years. It also has the highest rate of mortality amenable to health care, deaths that doctors and hospitals can prevent, and has experienced the smallest reduction in that measure in the past decade. The ways to fix these issues, according to the Commonwealth Fund experts, are to increase the rate of insurance coverage and access to primary care, streamline the insurance system so that there are less administrative hurdles for doctors, and funnel more money toward better nutrition and housing rather than specialty care. On a call with reporters, experts from the think tank said they had not yet had a chance to closely examine the revised health care bill. But it is rather similar to the past Republican repeal and replace proposals, especially with approach to Medicaid. The new bill would allow insurers to sell health plans that charge sick people more, cover only some health problems, or deny coverage based on pre-existing conditions, as long as they also sell Obamacare-compliant plans. The bill would also make cuts to Medicaid, the health insurance program for the poor. A score for this bill from the Congressional Budget Office is expected next week, but the agency's previous estimate was that 22 million Americans would lose coverage under a plan like this. In general, the proposals we've seen would reverse the progress, especially on insurance coverage, said Eric Schneider, Senior Vice President for Policy and Research at the Commonwealth Fund, on the call. We suspect that alone would be taking us in a direction different from the solutions. The disparities we observe related to income would likely not get better under Medicaid cutbacks. As insurance coverage declines, the Commonwealth Fund authors say less access to primary care would make American health outcomes even worse. The Senate bill would also expand the use of health savings accounts, a way of paying insurance premiums before taxes are taken out, which Commonwealth Fund President David Blumenthal said only adds to the complexity of the American insurance. Simplifying insurance, meanwhile, would make it better. For example, American doctors spend a comparatively abnormal amount of time on getting patients needed medications or treatment because of coverage restrictions, the Commonwealth Fund finds, and having patients who are signed up for plans that don't cover certain conditions or procedures, or that demand high deductibles from them before care is provided, would not remedy that. But according to this report, a single-payer system is not necessarily the only way to go. One of the top performers in the Commonwealth Fund's model is the Netherlands, a country where insurers are predominantly private companies who sell their plans to customers, many of whom are subsidized by the federal government. In other words, it looks like Obamacare on steroids. In the Netherlands, insurance is considered a social service, and it's much more heavily regulated than in the United States. People are required to buy insurance, just like under Obamacare, so less than 1% of the population is uninsured. Premiums are funded in part through payroll taxes and in part through subsidies that much of the population receives, according to a 2009 paper by Washington and Lee University law professor Timothy Jost. The list of essential benefits is generous and also regulated by the government. Rather than allow insurers to pick only the healthiest customers to insure, the Dutch government redistributes the risk among insurers by making those with healthier risk pools pay into a pot of money that other less fortunate insurers can draw from. Dutch people all pay a deductible of around $500, and unlike in the United States, providers there aren't allowed to balance bill if insurance doesn't fully cover their services. What's more, primary care doctors provide after-hours care, which helps explain why 77% of Dutch people say they saw a doctor or nurse on the same or next day the last time they needed medical care. Granted, the Dutch government has faced the typical health care quandaries, like how to control costs while giving people access to the procedures they need. But at least according to this report, they are doing much better than the United States is. It serves as a counterpoint to the popular view among some liberals that you must have single payer for good health care. You do, however, need to get almost all of your population insured and treat insurers more like public utilities than freewheeling upstarts. Today's second story, how the Grateful Dead nearly solved the problem with live music. The band's innovative sound system made them sound better than ever. It also nearly broke them. This story written by John Hendrickson. Picture yourself at a concert. If you're standing by the soundboard, usually near the rear center of the venue, you'll enjoy the best possible version of the band's performance. What the sound guy, whose job it is to make everything coalesce inside the room, hears. But if you step away to grab a beer and end up watching from a different place, you'll hear something else. At an outdoor show, the experience is even more varied because of the open acoustics and elements such as wind, which break up sound waves. Far too often, the song you've waited all night for may finally reach your ears as a distorted puddle. How does a band ensure that it sounds like the most pristine version of itself, no matter where the show takes place or where the audience listens? In the early 1970s, the Grateful Dead tried to solve this dilemma with the help of their on-again, off-again sound engineer, Owsley Bear Stanley, who conceptualized one of the boldest innovations in music history, a literal wall of sound. On hits such as the Ronettes' Be My Baby, the music producer Phil Spector had famously created a figurative wall of sound by layering instruments and orchestral sweeps. But the Dead's wall was essentially a behemoth sound system, a hulking electrical mess of amps, speakers, wires, like a menacing heavy metal rig in Mad Max Road Fury, but far larger, louder, and perhaps more ludicrous. The grand idea was both utopian and egalitarian. The wall placed virtually every piece of technology needed for a live show behind the group, allowing the crowd to hear precisely what the Dead heard as they played. The wall, the journalist Brian Anderson writes in his new book, Loud and Clear, weighed as much as a dozen full-grown elephants and stretched the length of a regulation basketball court. At each tour stop, roadies would assemble the nearly 600 speakers that, when operable, stood at about the height of a small apartment building and sounded as loud as a jet engine at close range. During outdoor shows, fans could be up to a quarter of a mile away from the stage and still hear Jerry Garcia's guitar runs with depth and clarity. But a relatively short time after its creation, the complexity and expense of maintaining the wall catalyzed the band's first serious brush with burnout, and, Anderson argues, played a factor in its hiatus. In trying to shorten the pathway from instrument to eardrum, the Dead's wall had simultaneously created a host of previously non-existent issues. On paper, the wall was a tool to expand the scope of their sky-reaching jams. More than any of their rock contemporaries, the Dead were known for extended, full-band improvisation. But relying on engineering in order to achieve a perfect sound brought a new set of anxieties. Because there was frequently some glitch with the wall, the band was often held back from reliably playing at its best. Stanley helped the Dead reach a new stratosphere of live performance, but he also established an impossible standard, one the band couldn't measure up to. Grateful Dead fandom invites and thrives on obsession. Though the Dead's jam band sound is undoubtedly groovy, many of its songs concern heavy themes, such as life and death. There's a deceptive weight to their songs, even when the tunes feel bright. The music is an ongoing search to unlock something hidden in the recesses of your mind. Though the band has a wonderful collection of studio recordings, the real juice is in the live stuff. The thousands of concerts performed over dozens of years, with a different set list every night. There's a lot to get lost in, and from their early days as a touring band, the Dead won legions of stoned and tripping devotees. Anderson's book, though, is dizzying in a different way. It's a detailed, almost show-by-show breakdown of the band's live performances across its first decade, roughly 1965 to 1974, augmented by insider stories. Readers meet not only Stanley, but also other engineers, roadies, and crew members who worked long hours under difficult conditions to help the Dead put on incomparable shows. But undergirding this occasionally exhausting narrative effort is a tale about the tension between innovation and hubris. The wall was, in a sense, a physical manifestations of a brainiac's acid trip. After Stanley took LSD at a legendary Dead show at an upstate New York speedway, Anderson writes, he believed that he could weave an unbreakable connection between the wall, the band, and the crowd. His acid-tinged goal with the wall was hooking it up to a whole sea of people like one mind, he said. For years, most other bands had played the same way in concert, with instruments connected to amps and amps and vocals running through the house PA. Even when traveling with their own sound guy, they'd still be beholden to each venue's setup, unless they toted all of their own gear, which just wasn't realistic. The wall, in theory, allowed for both top-notch sound and show-by-show consistency. In practice, though, it was an unwieldy nightmare. Speakers often blew out or failed mid-show. Stanley drifted in and out of the band's orbit. Other engineers and roadies expanded on his original visions. All the while, maintaining the rig became more convoluted. The band kept booking larger venues, thus requiring more sonic power, more crew members, and more attention to detail. Peak functionality was far from guaranteed, and Anderson convincingly makes the case that many early versions of the wall sounded better than the official wall shows in 1974, because the smaller scale allowed for relatively more control. Though it was far from an efficient process, early iterations could still take 5 hours to set up and another 5 to break down. Within the band itself, the wall was divisive. Bassist Phil Lesh called the wall apocalyptic, but also compared it to the voice of God. For him, the wall allowed for the most generally satisfying performance experience of my life with the band. Bob Weir, who sang and played guitar, called the wall insane and a logistical near impossibility. Drummer Bill Kreutzmann, according to Anderson, said it was a creature that was super cool to look at, but impossible to tame. And Garcia, it seems, would have been fine keeping things a little more down to earth. At the wall's official debut in March 23 of 1974, technical difficulties led to Garcia's guitar volume plunging moments into the first song. When you listen to this show today, the beginning sounds, well, kind of crappy. In the end, the Dead played only a few dozen shows with the fully built-up wall, as the cost and draining elaborateness of touring with the device eventually became too much. At the end of 1974, the Dead downsized its crew and, in Garcia's words, dumped the structure. When they hit the road again almost 2 years later, their sound setup was more practical, in essence sacrificing the perfect for the sustainable. They remained road dogs until Garcia's death in 1995 and have kept offshoots of the band rolling along since. Though I never saw the band perform with Garcia, I was 7 years old when he died of a heart attack, I've seen its different configurations over the years. Last summer I saw Dead and Company play as part of their residency at the Sphere in Las Vegas. That night demonstrated the clearest and most all-encompassing live sound I'd ever experienced. Most people have heard about the Sphere's mind-bending visuals and Mondo LED screens. Few may realize that it also contains 167,000 individual speakers, including in each seat. Though I was able to lose myself in the show, a very real part of me almost would have preferred hearing the same songs outside in the sun, in an uncontrolled setting, where any number of variables, the breeze, a storm, air pressure, might have affected the sound. Imperfection can feel just right, in a different way, as technical perfection. It's freeing to accept that something might always be a little off, no matter the Herculean effort. The Dead seem to accept this, too. Anderson's book makes a compelling argument that reaching for total audio domination was, and is, a noble endeavor, albeit one rife with pitfalls. But even the most advanced rig in the world doesn't necessarily make the songs any good. That much is up to the band. And just to reiterate, this last article was a book review. The book is entitled Loud and Clear: The Grateful Dead's Wall of Sound and the Quest for Audio Perfection, written by Brian Anderson. Our third article, an IRS regulation change that could sow societal division. Churches are now allowed to endorse political candidates. They should resist the temptation. This is written by Esau McCauley. Growing up, I went to a politically active church that frequently had politicians visit. My pastor recognized them as visitors during the announcements, but he did not invite them to speak. He usually said the same thing. I have my political opinions, but I won't say them here. Ask me outside of church. His stance was in line with an IRS regulation dating to the Dwight D. Eisenhower administration, which said nonprofit organizations, including churches, could not endorse political candidates. The IRS recently changed its rules to allow houses of worship to make such endorsements. But as a pastor of a church and a professor who teaches future ministers at a divinity school, I hope my fellow clergy won't act on this new freedom. This is not to say that churches should remain altogether silent on politics. I was raised in the Southern Black church tradition, which did not have the luxury of separating spiritual and political matters. Our churches came into existence when slavery was the law of the land. My ancestors were forced to answer the question, where were the laws of enslavement what God intended for our people? I am grateful to those who said that God willed abolition and liberation for those who took a political question, how to understand slavery, and answered it theologically. The church should concern itself solely with spiritual matters, can be uttered only by those whose ancestors never felt the sting of the whip and the chain. Bearing witness against unjust laws is essential. Endorsing candidates, however, is likely to be destructive. Over the past two decades, I have served in churches on three continents and weighed in on political issues in print and from the pulpit. But I have never felt that making direct affirmations of political candidates was necessary to serve my congregations well. I don't want my members to believe that being faithful to God entails voting in exactly the same way as their pastor. The difference between making moral judgments and endorsing candidates may seem slight, but it respects the conscience and liberty of lay people. Very few candidates tick all the moral boxes of any religious tradition. Voting involves considering the office to which a person is elected and the types of influence that they could have on a given issue. Christians of goodwill can weigh these matters and come to divergent conclusions. Believers may decide to refrain from voting or choose a third party because, in their view, neither majority candidate is acceptable. To believe that churches can direct the laity on how to vote, whether for members of the school board or for the president of the country, is to deny the Christian teaching that all humans are made in the image of God and can understand and follow His will themselves. The IRS justified its change by saying that pastoral endorsements are, quote, like a family discussion concerning candidates, end quote. Although the church often describes itself as a family, the analogy does not hold when it comes to endorsements. Many churches live stream their services on platforms such as YouTube and Facebook. The only families that broadcast their dinners to thousands of people are on reality TV. If a large, influential church endorses candidates, it will not be a family matter. It will be national news. This in turn could put pressure on other churches to issue counter-endorsements. Remaining neutral might be seen as a stance in itself. Pastors of churches, large and small, run the risk of being drawn into endorsement wars. Pastoral endorsements heighten American political divisions. Studies have long shown that Democrats and Republicans tend to get their information from separate media outlets and to run in different social circles. Churches are among the few places attempting to gather people from across the political spectrum. Endorsements, however, may lead congregants to attend churches that support their favorite candidates, turning a previously neutral gathering space into a politically charged one. Because of these risks, some Christian denominations resist making political endorsements, regardless of what the government allows. The Catholic Church, for example, teaches that the Church, because of her commission and competence, is not to be confused in any way with the political community. To keep that distinction clear, Catholic clergy are usually prohibited from running for political office. Nonetheless, priests and other church officials are free to make moral judgments on political matters. Endorsing candidates would not be an expansion of the church's work, but a reduction. When the Catholic Saint Thomas More was martyred for running afoul of King Henry VIII, he was credited with saying, "I die the king's good servant and God's first." The point being, the church is most useful to the state when it reminds the government of the limits of its authority. I do not believe that Donald Trump's IRS, with its regulation change, was motivated by a desire to help the church serve God and love our neighbors well. Instead, I believe that the government thinks the new policy will be politically useful, even if it weakens relationships and threatens the health of our communities. The change is an attempt to get pastors to use the pulpit for ends for which it was never intended, a temptation we would do better to resist. The writer Esau McCauley is an associate professor of the New Testament at Wheaton College. He's the author of God's Colorful Kingdom Storybook Bible, and he is also the host of the Esau McCauley podcast. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are sight and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.